Welcome to Studio 1776. I'm your host, Daniel Leach. I am joined today by Rexton Lotus Justice, and we're going to do an interview here with an update on her situation. Anyways, welcome to the program, Rexton. How are you?
Hey, how's it going? Well, we're still fighting the paper chest war here. Got a couple cases in some various places I don't really want to talk about until we get some response from them, because I don't want to undermine potentially, you know, the political, in disclosing it might find some people under some scrutiny politically or by the powers that be, or they might make decisions we'd like them to make. So let's just say there's a couple things going on there in some various courts and arenas that we're seeing, putting some feelers out. But what I wanted to talk about real quick is, you know, you got a lot of time in jail, and what I pretty much do is the basic necessities: eat, sleep, and go to the bathroom, shower, and write about between 4 and 8 hours a day, because I'm so busy with multiple cases and multiple jurisdictions, but also read. And there's a book that I was given by one of the people, the women here, and it's called Before We Were Yours, the novel by Lisa Wingate. It's an interesting story because it's a fiction, but it's based on some historical facts of children in the 40s and 50s, and being between the 1920s and 50s, being stolen by people, you know, saying that they were doing great deeds. And it's a fiction about people coming together after that, after being made orphans by theft and graft and stuff. But I wanted to read a section, a note from the author, because this is kind of, because it speaks today of what's really going on again. And so I want to read a couple paragraphs here for you from this book called Before We Were Yours by Lisa Wingate. It's in the notes for the author in the back. It says, the story of Georgia Tan and the Memphis branch of the Tennessee Children's Home Society is a bizarre and sad paradox. There is little doubt that the organization rescued many children from deplorable, dangerous circumstances, or simply accepted children who were unwanted and placed them in loving homes. There is also little doubt that countless children were taken from loving parents without cause or due process, and never seen again by their desperately grieving biological families. Survivors' accounts bear out the empty-armed birth mothers pine for their missing children for decades, and that many of those children were placed in holding facilities where they were neglected, molested, abused, and treated as objects, and also die, folks. A lot of these people died. Children died. Single mothers, indigent parents, women in mental wards, and those seeking help through welfare services and maternity clinics were particularly targeted. Birth mothers were duped into signing papers while under postpartum sedation, were told that turning over temporary custody was necessary to secure medical treatment for their children, or were often simply informed that their babies had died. Children who lived through stints in the home's custody, those who were old enough to have memories of their prior lives, reported having been whisked from front porches, from roadsides while walking to school, and yes, from houseboats on the river, especially if you were poor and you lived, stayed, or stopped over in the proximity of Memphis, your children were at risk. Blondes like the Fosse siblings were particularly popular in Georgia Tan's system and were often targeted by spotters who worked in medical facilities and public aid clinics. Average residents of the city were unaware of her methods, were not unaware of her work. For years, citizens watched for newspaper advertisements bearing photos of adorable babies and children, underscored by captions like, yours for the asking, want a real live Christmas present, and Georgia, George wants to play catch, but he needs a daddy. Georgia Tam was heralded as the mother of modern adoption and was even consulted by Eleanor Roosevelt on matters of child welfare. To the general public, Tam was simply matronly, well-meaning woman who devoted her life to rescuing children in need. Her celebration of children adoption by wealthy, well-known families helped to popularize the idea of adoption in general and dispel the widespread belief that orphan children were undesirable and inherently damaged. Georgia's high-profile list included political figures such as New York Governor Herbert Lehman and Hollywood celebrities such as Joan Crawford and June Allison and her husband, Dick Powell. Former staff members of Tan's orphanage in the Memphis whispered of as many as 7 babies at a time being sprinted away under cover of darkness for transportation to foster homes in California, New York, and other states. In reality, these children were often being shipped off to profitable out-of-state adoptions in which TAMS pocketed the lion's share of exorbitant delivery fees. When interviewed about her methods, Georgia unabashedly extolled the virtues of removing children from loving parents who could not possibly raise them properly and place them with people of high type. From a modern perspective, it's hard to imagine how Georgia TAMS and her network managed to operate largely unchecked for decades, or where she found workers willing to turn a blind eye to the inhumane treatment of children in the organization's group homes and in unlicensed boarding facilities like the one where Ryle and her siblings land. Yet it happened. At one point, the U.S. Children's Bureau sent an investigator to Memphis to probe the city's soaring infant mortality rate. In a 4-month period in 1945, a dysentery epidemic had caused the death of 40 to 50 children under the care of Georgia's facility, despite the efforts of a doctor who volunteered medically services there. Georgia, however, insisted that only 2 children had been lost. Under pressure, the state legislature passed a law mandating the licensing of every child's boarding home in Tennessee. The newly passed legislation included a subsection providing an exemption for all boarding homes employed under Georgia TAMS agency. So then she goes on to say, so while the characters in the story are fictional, these characters' experiences were inspired by those reported by survivors. There were also many who, due to abuse, neglect, illness, and inadequate medical attention, did not live to tell their stories. They are the silent victims of an unregulated system fueled by greed and financial opportunity. Estimates as to the number of children who may have been simply vanished under Georgia TAMS management range from as high as 500,000. Thousands more disappeared into adoptions for profit in which names, birth dates, birth records were altered to prevent biological families from finding their children. One would assume, given these awful statistics, that Georgia TAMS reign would have eventually ended amid a firestorm of public revelations, police inquiries, and legal action. If Before We Were Yours was entirely fictional, that's how I would have written its end, with scenes of swift and certain justice. Sadly, this is not the case. Georgia's many years in the adoption business did not draw to a close until 1950. At a press conference that September, Governor Gordon Browning, skirting the heartbreaking human tragedy of it all and instead discussing the money, Ms. TAMS, he reported, had benefited illegally to the tune of $1 million, equivalent to $10 million today, while employed by the Tennessee Children's Home Society. Despite the revelations of her crimes, TAM was, by then, beyond the reach of legal action. Within days of the press conference, she succumbed to uterine cancer and died at a home in her own bed. A newspaper exposé ran opposite her obituary on the front page of a local paper. Her children's home was closed and an investigator appointed, but he soon found himself stymied by powerful people with secrets, reputation, and in some cases, adoptions to preserve. While the closing of the home gave grieving birth families reason to hope, that hope was quickly snatched from them. Legislatures and political powers brokered past laws legalizing even the most questionable of her adoptions and sealing her records. Of the 22 wards remaining in TAM's care at the time of her death, only 2, who had already been rejected by their adopted families, were returned to their birth parents. Thousands of birth families would never know what became of their children. The general public sentiment was that having been given over from poverty to privilege, the children were better off where they were, no matter the circumstances of their adoptions. While some adoptees, separated siblings, and birth families were able to find one another through pieced together memories, documents spirited from courthouse files, and the assistance of private investigators, Georgia TAMS records would not finally be opened to her victims until 1995. For many birth parents and adoptees who grieved their losses throughout their lifetimes, that was simply too late for others. It was the beginning of long-delayed family reunions and the opportunity to finally tell their stories. If there is one overreaching lesson to be learned from the Foss family, the characters in this book, and from the true life stories of the Tennessee Children's Home Society, it is that babies and children, no matter what corner of the world they hail from, are not commodities or objects or blank slates, as George Tam so often represented her wards. They are human beings with histories and needs and hopes and dreams of their own. Now, the reason why I read this is because nothing has changed, folks. Nothing has changed. CPS is just doing the work of the Tennessee Children's Home Society. That's all they've done. Children's names are changed. They become initials. They rename them. They give them new Social Security numbers. They hide their identities. They're taken from people who are purported to be low class, drug addicts, convicted felons. But I'm going to tell you, folks, they target women. They target women to take their children in the judicial system. So the reason why I read this excerpt from this book written by Lisa Wingate is because nothing has changed from the Tennessee Children's Home Society crimes against children. They've just institutionalized them in child protective services. So, and for the same purposes, the powerful can buy children as commodities. In this book, there's the implication that they buy them for labor, for some for loving families, but they also buy children nowadays for not so nice things. And this is an old practice. I believe that my mother has told me that one of my grandfathers was stolen and relocated to a family in the Midwest who did end up wanting him because they wanted a son and adopted him and loved him a great deal. But he was basically stolen off the streets, probably during this time frame. So I know that one of my family members, one of my grandfathers or great-grandfathers, whatever, that happened to him. So they're doing the same things now, Daniel, that they did at the turn of the century, 100 years ago. They've just institutionalized it. And I was really drawn by this, the author's notes on this, because I'm reading it, she's writing it, thinking that these times have ended, and this is a horrible history, period of history, in the history of our country, where state legislatures and the powers that be and the rich and powerful were allowing someone operate criminally in literally the kidnapping of children off the side of the road, stealing them from families, particularly in this book, one of the children as a fictitious character is taken at birth from a mother, twins are, which I find really interesting because I know someone here who has been charged with a capital murder. And they have no corpus delicti. Her child was taken to the emergency room at Children's Hospital, and the child apparently dies 3 hours later, but no one in the family saw the body. No one in the family was allowed to see the body. They cannot produce the child. The child was purportedly immediately cremated by order of Child Protective Services. Well, if you're like me, and you know that Child Protective Services is just basically a kidnapping agency for the state, doing the dirty work of the Tennessee Children's Society in the modern era, you realize the likelihood is that child is alive and was stolen from that mother, and yet there's a mother sitting in jail here that they want to charge for the death of her child because he purportedly died in the hospital, but the hospital, Children's Hospital, never produced the body to anybody in the family. These are scary, scary things, folks, and these are happening daily in this country. So what I'm going to tell you is that this period of time from 1920 to 1950 where organizations called the Tennessee Children's Home Society openly kidnapped children and sold them to wealthy, well-to-do, high-class people is still going on. It never changed. They just institutionalized it. And so I wanted to do a show this morning just to give you guys an idea that this is the topic that got me targeted. This is why I fight and do what I do and write 5 to 8 hours a day to try to gain my freedom. This is why I was targeted by the establishment. This is why they came at me and my wife, because we can prove that they did this to our son, that they basically, not basically, by facts of law, they kidnapped him and then trafficked him, and we have no through the agencies of state. So there are thousands and tens of thousands of children that has to happen to. In probably the 10 years that I've been trying to expose human trafficking by the use of the birth certificate as an instrument of commerce. It's a debt instrument. So, Daniel, do you have any comments for me on this?
Well, you know, I've been following, you know, this child kidnapping phenomena or, you know, abductions from the CPS, you know, and it goes back to the Clinton days where, you know, they passed laws that allowed CPS to get paid for basically taking people's children, you know, and once they did that, you know, that increased the numbers and the ability of CPS workers to go after the children. And you're talking about the very dark things. You know, we're finding out that these kids are being trafficked, not just to loving homes, but they're being sexually used and abused by, you know, these people. You know, and people are given incentives to basically go out and adopt children because the families are also getting paid, you know, to house these kids. You know, I have one client that was in a famous case back in the 80s, Anna Taylor, and she was one of those kids that was on the news because it was called Kids in Cages. You know, these families had put these kids, literally locked them in cages in their homes. And it's sad to say that, you know, these people are still out there, you know, these kind of monsters, I call them, that are doing these things to kids. You know, not only are they abducting these kids and sexual trafficking them, but, you know, the darkest part about these is a lot of these kids are used as human sacrifice. And then the people, they drink their blood. You know, they torture them, they drink their blood. And, you know, people would say that's outrageous. It's not really true. That's not happening. And it surely is happening. You need to research this stuff. You know, and they don't even try to hide what they're doing. I mean, they even have businesses out there where you can buy the blood. You can buy the blood on the open market. I mean, it's sick what's happening. Anyways, that's my thought.
No. Yeah, very much so. And, you know, the point is that this basically just moved from the private market to the market of the state. The state is now the baby trafficker, and the state is now the criminal. And the interesting point about, you know, what I read about this particular society is that the legislatures accommodated it, and they promoted it. The powers that be promoted it, especially with the changing of the children's names, which they now do under what they call, you know, HIPAA and all this other stuff. That
you have 1 minute remaining.
I can actually call back if you'd like to continue this another 20. But, you know, they literally are doing the same things. They've made it so you can't track. That's why I always, you know, say our son's name, Clayton Michael Bates. He's CB in the paperwork. And that's what they do to these kids. They deprive them of their name. So then the paperwork through the state, if your child's been kidnapped by CPS, you go to the records of the court, and you can't find the kid's name on the records. They've destroyed their names. They hide their names in the court system themselves to accommodate you not being able to track where they've kidnapped and sent your child. This is the exact same thing they were doing privately before. Now it's just institutionalized. And so I'll stop here so we can call back and do another 20. And but I, you know, somber Saturday for me. You know, I finished reading this book this morning and just wanted to share this with people that it hasn't changed. Nothing has changed.
Thank you for using GTL.
All right, guys. So I want to encourage our listeners, if you are somebody out there that is listening to this program and you've had your kids stolen from the CPS, if you have experienced this personally, you know, leave a comment. You can also, you know, call my number. We could talk about this. We could do a broadcast. We can expose, you know, the things that are happening. I do this quite a bit with a lot of different people dealing with the CPS through a website called courtroomwatch.com. We do a lot of things that help families get their kids back. I also have contacts with a lot of different people in this movement that are advocates that are actually helping to get kids back as well. We do a lot of things with medical kidnapping that basically deals with trying to get people out of situations. I did an interview last week with a man named Robert Tanner, and we talked about ways to prevent you from being medically kidnapped. Matter of fact, we're going to be doing a program here specifically just on the topic of medical kidnapping on our next podcast with Robert Tanner. So look forward to listening to that. If you're listening to this program, subscribe, leave a comment. Also, if you want to get a hold of me, you can reach me on my personal cell phone number, 701-339-3131. Again, my number is 701-339-3131. You could also email me at Daniel J. Leach Jr. 1975@gmail.com. Or you could also contact me through Courtroom Watch on our contact page, or email me at courtroomwatch@gmail.com. So we're just waiting for Lotus to call back in and we can continue with the program here. Also, I want to put encourage people to go to our social website, our independent social. Here she is. I'm going to hold on a second.
Hello, this is a prepaid call from
inmate at the Franklin County Corrections 2.
To accept this call, press 0. To refuse this call, hang up or press 1. To prevent calls from this facility, press 9. For a rate quote, press 8. Hello, this is a prepaid call from
inmate at the Franklin County Corrections 2.
To accept this call, press 0. Your current balance is $16.41. This call is from a correction facility and is subject to monitoring and recording. Thank you for using GTL.
Hey there, we got a good connection?
Yeah, I believe so. I'm not quite sure what's going on, but I think Studio 1776 possibly, hold on. No, it looks like we're still here on Studio 1776.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure, obviously.
Okay.
Cause,
you never know about the technology or what happens to the technology.
Right,
okay.
I do this from my phone, and, what happens is we do these interviews, and then once we hang up, it automatically is posted to my website over at the antideepstateparty.com. And from there, I take that, download it, and then I upload it to my podcast.
Right.
And then that it gets dispersed, all
right,
over the place. Apple, we're on Apple Podcasts, we're on Spotify, all over the place.
Awesome.
Yeah, so, I do have a question for you before we go on and continue with this. Are you able to listen to podcasts or get on the internet and anything like that?
No, it just took me 19 months to get a notary by court order here, folks.
All right, because I did an interview with a man named Robert Tanner last weekend, and he had some really good things to talk about, and specifically that was recorded for you. Now, I don't want to take his words and try to tell you what he said. So I kind of want, at some point in the future, I want to play that audio for you, because I think, some of the things that he said could possibly help you in your...
Are you talking about Roger Tanner? Did you say, what was his name?
Robert Tanner.
Okay, I think I know who you're... I think you know. It's not Roger, it's Robert.
Robert, yes, Robert Tanner.
Okay, yeah, I may or may not know him. Did he imply that he knew me?
He looked into your case, and I think he knows who you are. But a mutual friend of mine turned me on to Robert, and so We did a 3-hour interview podcast, and we're actually going to be doing another one coming up here about medical kidnapping. And so he's actually been through the system. He's been in jail. He's been in prison. And so he was basically kind of like giving people advice, not legal advice legally, but more like his experiences. And he basically was giving some thoughts out that, you know, I'd like to play those for you at some point here in the near future. So maybe it could help you out. Basically.
I appreciate that. I mean, if I can, I mean, you know, we're at 20 minutes at a time on these phones when they are actually working, and we have to work around, you know, they have 20 some odd women in here trying to get all their families or attorneys and their children. So we have to work around that. But I mean, you know, the point of fact is, you know, I'm sitting here, the system itself is corrupt. The system of jurisprudence, their jurisprudence, well, jurisprudence doesn't exist. Their judiciary, the judicial system of the country at this point in time, is really an obstructive instrument that that requires you to jump through administrative rules and codes of private bar unions to actually exercise constitutional rights or to even get a court to recognize that you have them. Okay. In my case, they've been allowed to come into the house without a warrant, try to kill my wife and I, and yet hold me, not the state, openly violated the law, and yet they're not indicted. And I'm the one sitting here in the presumption, and I'm supposed to sit here according to their court system until I have a trial, and then either if I'm found guilty or not, if I'm not found guilty, then I'm just supposed to think that's okay, that they held me in prison against the Fourth Amendment in violation, prima facie violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's like, so they can commit a crime, and I have to prove they didn't commit it. You know, I have to prove that they committed it. So they can commit a crime. The state, with its massive wealth, its large armies with untold resources and money and power, are being allowed to commit crimes against the American people, and your judicial system is trying to tell you that the presumption goes to the right of the state, not to the right of the people. And they're institutionalized people, and they're doing things to people that are they're holding us in custody, and we have to prove what they did wrong. Okay. And how are they getting these indictments? You know, how are they getting indictments from people when the state is obviously breaking the law? How do you acquire an indictment whenever the state admits to entering a house without a warrant and tries to shoot you? That is, prima facie, should not be an indictment. How could they even seek an indictment? Oh, wait, that's because in my case, the agency that actually brought the charge was the Bureau of Criminal Investigation. An agent for BCI brought the charges that sit in the municipal case, folks. So the instrument of the state is supposed to be investigating whether or not sheriffs are following the law and agencies of state are following the law in the actions of law enforcement brought the charges against me the day of the shooting before they investigated anything. Then they went and got search warrants for property, upon the property. Then they collected the evidence. Then they processed the evidence. Then they produced a fraudulent report that obstructs exculpatory evidence and basically lies about critical facts. So a division of the Attorney General's office brought the charges against me, folks. The day that they came into my house without a warrant and tried to kill me and my wife. So, you know, this situation is egregious. And why is the judiciary set up so that the state is being allowed to violate the Constitution prima facie, and then we're held in jail for years at a time to have to prove our innocence? That's because the system is set up to incarcerate, to seize you, and then coerce you into contracting with and taking a plea deal, even if you aren't guilty of anything, because you're sitting rotting in jail. And I'm going to tell you, this jail here violates international law. It violates human rights. It doesn't keep people safe. It damages their psyche. I've personally seen them torture the mentally ill. I've personally seen them can testify to their treatment of people who truly have mental health issues. And it's egregious and it's criminal. This is your system of judiciary? That's not what our country is, folks. So the judiciary of this system is criminal RICO. That's all it is. The way it's treating, and they're using this RICO system, this criminal enterprise, to target the impoverished, the quote, low class, as they would call, the asociales that the powers that run this country don't like, the patriots, the constitutionalists, mothers and fathers who want to have some say in their child's upbringing and education, and they use this system to target you and steal your children from those classes of people. They're doing it on a daily basis. And,
you know what's interesting, too, is it's not just the CPS systems that are targeting, you know, people, but you're looking at the welfare system that, you know, makes it an incentive to break up your family. You know, if you need help, you know, you can't have the man in the home or you're not going to receive that assistance.
Right. Well, that's because you can only have one daddy. That's the state.
Right.
The state's your daddy. You can't have a daddy in the household.
Yeah.
And what's criminal about all this is that we actually have a Sustake trust that they are supposed to tap for our benefit, not to sustain their criminal overlaying, you know, organized crime system that they call the United States government and the states of X. So these families that are living impoverished have rights to benefits that would raise them out of poverty. And I'm not talking about a welfare state where there's a quid pro quo. We give you your benefits, but we get to regulate your lives. That's not how it's supposed to be. It's we give you your benefits because you need it. They're not supposed to be regulating the behavior of the people with benefits that are owed to them, that were given to them by their being incarnated in this realm. So they're literally inserting themselves as interpleaders and interlopers and tortfeasors into your rights to an allodial trust that is protected by your constitutional substantial rights to be given to you by grant of God. These people are criminals. They are organized crime. They are abusing the system. They are defrauding the system. They are affecting false claims. They are issuing false bonds. They are defrauding the Treasury. They are raping the Treasury. And if I'm worth $6 billion, folks, if everyone out there is worth, let's say, even a billion, I mean, our youngest son is worth half a million, over almost $500 million. He's eight. Well, that was 2 years ago. If a child is worth $500 million, and every child in this country, every person in this country is worth a billion, how are we even possibly bankrupt? And how are we possibly, what are they doing with all the money? What are they doing with all the money, folks? They're not giving it to the people. They're not solving poverty. They're not solving social injustice. What are they doing with the money that's owed to the people? You know what they're doing? They're warring against us. And then they have all these black ops that we don't know what they're doing. They're living high on the hog. They're having little parties on us. They're living in a world that we can't even fathom with technology that we've been denied on our dime, on our dime. So we are the trustor, and we're being treated as slaves. We are the holders of this trust, and they are treating us like chattel. And that needs to change. And I don't care who you point a finger to. Everyone who is an instrument and an agency of state and an agent of state has a fiduciary duty to stop these crimes against humanity and the people of this realm. I don't care who you are. You're all failing. If you're not fixing the problem and you're not exposing the problem and you're not stopping it, you are criminally culpable under the law of perpetuating it, perpetuating the crimes. Again, kidnapping is a crime of the Treasury. Perpetuating kidnapping is a crime of Treasury. So in our case, I have courts that have perpetuated kidnapping. Court systems, court banks, those are banks, folks. Courts are banks that hold bonds and issue bonds. So think of a bank as a bond issuing, a court as a bond issuing bank, because that's what they're doing. So,
you know, speaking of the bonds, you know, something Robert Tanner talked about was the bonds of the judges, you know.
Yeah.
Is that something that you've looked into at all as far as the bonds?
Yeah, we're looking into that, and there is always that. Those are definitely, because they basically have to be suretized against certain. The full faith and credit clause of the Constitution, which is substantiated in Title 28, 1738, sustains that any time a bond is issued, when the state violates a statute, is a fraudulent bond. So in
right.
my case, they violated, you know, and the judges have to be bonded to get they have to be indemnified against unlawful action, and that's what the bonds are for. So that, you know, they're surety.
Something else he talked about as well is he talked about going after their insurance for medical malpractice. Is that something that you would be?
You mean in the Esquire system or in the doctor title and nobility?
I'm not quite sure, but he talked about
all of these titles of nobility licensures have to be indemnified. And if you carry a license with the state actually indemnifies you too. That's some people, but in particular, these certain agencies have to hold independent individual bonds.
Right. One thing that Robert talked about as well is when you get put into the system, how the security guards are not supposed to strip search or any type of way touch your body, and that's supposed to be done by a nurse, a registered nurse. And if they have actually done anything like that, you pretty much can go after them for medical malpractice.
Oh, right. Well, not only I understand that, but in my case, I've been denied medical care multiple times. I currently have a fractured shoulder blade, and I'm pretty sure I actually have a broken foot. That was in late November. I have yet to see a specialist. This is the second time that I've been assaulted I've been assaulted four times in this jail, but this is the second time, third time, I've been assaulted in this jail where I've had an injury that required medical care, and I've only gotten medical care in the required, what would be considered reasonable time, if at all, in one situation, and that was because I insisted that I had a torn retina. They weren't even going to do it. So, I mean, people get hurt in here all the time, and they do nothing. They don't have cameras where they're supposed to have it, folks. They don't care. They allow people to be feloniously assaulted, even raped. There have been rapes in here, and I think... And they do nothing about it. They say, oh, well, you could press charges when you get out. I've been feloniously assaulted like five times in this jail, folks. I've been feloniously assaulted more times in the 18 months, not counting this felonious assault of my arrest and the things that happened on the day. More times, I've been feloniously assaulted like twice in my life, prior, in my 53 years. But in the last 19, 20 months dealing with this state and the previous criminal charges, other times I've been feloniously assaulted by anybody where I wasn't able to get remedy. I mean, they don't care. And their job is to provide the safety and security of people here. They're supposed to provide, they're supposed to keep us safe. Remember, bail is only supposed to ensure that you show up to court. So really, technically speaking, the only people who are supposed to be in jail are people who have a historical practice of not showing up to court. Habeas is like that. People who are just charged are not supposed to be kept under excessive bond where they can't get out, so that they're held in their due process rights and their freedoms and their liberties are denied. Their families fall apart. They lose their business. That's not supposed to happen. It's not supposed to be a punishment by law, and yet that's what they're using it for. Because if they punish you enough, then you'll surrender to their tyranny and their despotism. And they can get you to plead to a charge that they've overcharged you, that you didn't necessarily, and so they could coerce you into surrendering to their form of corrupt antitrust government that is not supposed to be our government. This is not our government, folks. Where you live, the government that is controlling this country and this realm is not your lawful government. They are a criminal enterprise run by unions that have designated themselves exempt from antitrust, and everything they do is antitrust. Everything they do is antitrust. They are a monopolistic practice of heretical, lawless haters of the Constitution. Okay, and they are obstructionists to your rights. And, you know, when it goes back to these poor families, I can't even fathom the way my wife feels, but I know that it is an emotionally destructive thing for these women and fathers, and that it doesn't just destroy the family unit, it destroys people. It destroys them. And there's nothing more powerful than to have a state that can destroy the family and destroy the home. It's just another class of slavery. It's no different than taking, you know, black or white slaves held, taking the father off, you know, out of the family unit, and depriving the father of the family of the father, and then taking the women and children, separating them, and then stealing the children from the mothers. It's no different. It just looks different. It's no different. But, you know, my poor wife, I mean, I know that it is an emotionally damaging thing that she will never recover from. You can't recover years of missing your children. And I don't care. People can lambaste and say things about the types of people that lose their children. They need to shut up because they don't know anything about the factual aspects of things. And the truth be told is if this society were actually a Christian society, we have the capacity to eliminate poverty. We have the capacity to eliminate social injustice and the social stratifications and the class system. We have the capacity. We have the SSK Trust to do it. We just don't have a system of government that wants to solve all those problems. And we clearly don't have a base of people that think that that needs to happen, or else it would happen. They like to say, oh, well, I'm better than another person. So this isn't just an institutional issue of state, because the people who come from our society are running that. They're the spotters in this book. They're the handlers. They're the people that look for the disenfranchised and the maligned. Okay, but I'm going to tell you that, you know, I am an advocate for the marginalized and the helpless.
You have 1 minute remaining.
And if being an advocate and a champion for the marginalized and the helpless, it makes me a target of this criminal, heretical state, I'll wear that yoke. But all those people out there that aren't doing their job to help the marginalized and the helpless and the disenfranchised and the impoverished, they're not Christians, and they're not righteous, and they're definitely perpetuating a lawless state. And so, you know, there's a central issue within our society that this is being allowed to be perpetuated, that no one is raising arms en masse against what is happening. So I'm going to leave you with that. Thank you for letting me speak this morning. I love my family. I love my wife very much. I hope she's having a good day. I love all the children out there that are being targeted. And my heart goes out to all those families that have lost their children and had their children stolen. And my heart.
Thank you for using GTL.
Well, guys, once again, thank you guys for listening here at Social 1776, Studio 1776. Highly encourage you guys to go and sign up at our website, Social 1776. Create a profile. You can add groups, pages. We're working on setting up a fundraiser position as well. We got some bugs to work out on the site. But, yeah, go and sign up at Social 1776 and leave some comments if you guys are listening to this on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Or you can go and catch us over at Anti-Deep State Party. We have a page specifically for Rexton Lotus Justice on there with her contact information as far as, you know, being able to donate to the cause to help free Rexton Lotus Justice. Go over to Courtroom Watch. Check out what we're doing over there. We're working with Eric, the Freedom Screamer, Jones. And if you guys are listening to this and you have an issue with the CPS, feel free to reach out. I could be reached at 701-339-3131. If you know somebody that would be interested in, you know, being a part of the broadcast here, we do book reviews with people. We also do interviews with other activists talking about what they're doing, setting up their events. We're always looking for new people to interview. So, yeah, if you know somebody that you would like to hear on this broadcast, have them reach out to me, Daniel Leach, 701-339-3131. Thank you. God bless. And we'll catch you guys on the next interview. Till then, catch you on the flip side. God bless.